Thank you, Jim. My name's Les. I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace, the gift of this fellowship and people like you in rooms like this, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. That's been going on since August the 20th, 1977, and I'm very grateful for that. Very grateful to be here. I know there's one lady here that is her first meeting in Al-Anon. I hope we don't ruin you, ma'am. You just keep hanging around those lovely Al-Anon ladies. They've got an answer for you. I hope maybe I can have some, too. I'm glad Tim introduced me the way he did. It was not long ago that I was speaking at a place, and they introduced me as the star of the show. And I got home that night and told my wife. She said, "Have you looked up star yet in the dictionary?" And I said, "No." She said, "Try to." I looked it up, and it said a big mass of gas floating around out in outer space that is subject to explode at any moment. Tim was good to me. Thank you, Tim. The alcoholic comes to us just like I did, out of desperation. I came to you because you were the last house on the street. I'd been pronounced dead twice in March of 77, and I had come back to the point to where I was headed that way. That was my next stop, and this time it was going to be for real. And I had that night of August the 19th, 77, I had that moment of clarity that every alcoholic must have. And that clarity didn't reach out to God, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes why. But I was under a motel bed with my own excretion all over me, and I'd been there for 10 days. And I had intended for it to be the last of Les Williams. Because I had run the gamut of everybody I knew. My money was all gone. Everything was gone. I was bankrupt spiritually, physically, mentally, financially. I was bankrupt in every area of my life. And I had nowhere to turn. And I lay under that bed and couldn't get out of it. And it was about this time in the evening. And a thought ran through my head. I can't go on this away. And I hated me for more than I'd ever hated anything in my whole life. Because at that time, that night, I knew that I was headed towards death. And when I got that close to it again, I didn't like it. I didn't want that. I wanted something else. And I didn't know what I wanted, but had no idea what it was. 27 days later, I came to you people, and 27 days later, I had the second thing every alcoholic must have, and you gave it to me. Right down the road here, about 40 miles at Athens, Texas, I went to my first AA meeting on September the 16th, my 41st birthday. I hadn't had a drink in 27 days, and I was restless, irritable, and discontent, and ready to kill somebody. And if it was somebody, me, it'd be okay. And if it was you, it's okay. I just needed to do something. And I went to this meeting with this woman and this man. The woman died drunk. At the end, she had 9 months that day, and she died drunk at 62 years old. She never made 17 months. For you that know me and know and have heard me talk, you know that when I drink, I marry a whole lot. That I have, I don't know that that's a disease or not, but with alcoholism, it certainly is it is impetuous, I will tell you that, because I thought wedding cake was one of the four main food groups when I got to AA. I had gotten a divorce back in January, and I came to you people that night, and you gave me the one thing that every alcoholic must have, the second of the four things that he must have, he or she, and that is, you gave me hope. You gave me hope that there was a way up and a way out, because you were laughing, and I didn't see nothing funny nowhere. I was clean on the outside, but I definitely wasn't clean on the inside. I didn't automatically want what you had, but it was good enough for me with what I had, because I thought something. But I saw a sign in the room that night, and there's none on this room. I've been lucky enough to travel extensively in Alcoholics Anonymous the last 20 years and do what I'm doing tonight, and I have looked all over in Canada, in the United States, and in a little bit of Mexico. Look for my sign, and I can't find it anywhere. The sign had nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. It had everything to do with me. And the sign said, "It's what you learn after you think you know it all that's important." It's what you learn after you think you know it all that's important. The alcoholic knows the price of everything and the value of nothing, or at least this one did. And that sign is on my mantle and on my fireplace right now, and I see it every day because it's as important to me today as it was that day. But that day, I got that hope, and I got just a little bit of what this is all about. You know, this is not what we're on here. This is not dress rehearsal. Sobriety is not a destination. Sobriety is a journey. And the joy is in that journey. And we don't, this is not a dress rehearsal. This is the real thing. We're here because life and death teeters with we alcoholics on taking that next drink. And that's what we're here to avoid, is take away that next drink. And we were talking over here a few minutes ago, Patty and myself, before what's-his-name came in. And we were talking about the spirituality that the world seeks this day. I mean, I see more people looking for a spiritual way of life now than I ever have before in my life. And it is probably the biggest force, and I brag about this because I love AA and because it saved my life and gave me my life. But this is one of the biggest forces there is in the spiritual world today is Alcoholics Anonymous, because we not only believe it, we live it. And that's what this is all about. Our program is not a one-thing deal. It is not a one-day deal. And you can go to all the meetings. If you're new here and you're looking to get sober and you want to get sober and you've got that desperation that you really want to do something, we're going to talk about that the next 4 weeks, tonight and the next 3 weeks. But you can go to all the meetings you want to go to. And you can have all the fellowship you want to have. But if you don't do something about your disease, you will drink. Because meetings are absolutely important. Fellowship is absolutely important. But without the 12 steps, and that's them up here on the wall, that is the way of life that you must adopt. Just a little bit at a time, and you won't adopt it. It takes a while. It takes a long time. In fact, I don't know how long it takes. If you got my sobriety date, that's 25 years and 10 months and 17 days. And I haven't gotten it all down yet. But it's what you learn after you think you know it all that's important. So maybe I've got time to learn some more as we go along. But once the alcoholic comes in here, the first step, and this hadn't always been this way. Alcoholics Anonymous started June the 10th, 1935, when a doctor in Akron, Ohio, took his last drink of beer that morning. And a stockbroker was there with that doctor, and he took that last beer, and that was on June the 10th, 1935. And they didn't have much to go on, but it started. And mine and your life changed drastically that day, and most of us wasn't even born then. But as it came about, Bill Wilson was the man that was a stockbroker, and Bill had been given a few sets, a few tenets that he needed to go by if he was planning on getting sober by a friend of his that had been rescued out of a mission a few months back in November of 34. And Bill got sober on December the 11th, 1934. At 2 o'clock in the afternoon, he took his last drink. And he had these little tenets, and I'd like to read them to you because it's a long story getting to what we're going to talk about. But these are how the first people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were such a little of them, they just came one and one and one. Today we're over 3 million strong. We're in every country in the world now. There's not a place it's not as available as it is here to us in America, but it is available everywhere you go. And there is Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's people anxious, so anxious for it. And our neighbor Cuba is having about 28 groups a month to start. That's how hungry they are for it down there. And Romania is about the same way. But this is what they started out with. Not anything like what we've got today. But this is the five little things that they told Bill he was going to have to do if he was going to stay sober. And it came out of the Oxford Movement. The Oxford Movement, we were part of the Oxford Movement until September of 37. But at this time, this is all they had. And it said, I had to admit I was licked. Number two, I ought to take stock of myself and confess my defects to another person in confidence. I needed to make restitution for the harm I had done others. I ought to practice the kind of giving that has no price tag on it, giving on myself to somebody. I should pray to whatever God I thought there was for the power to carry out these simple precepts. And that was it. That's what they had. And then when Bill got sober, and Dr. Bob got sober, and a few other got sober, and in the they added some to that. They had what they called the six chunks of truth. And this is what those people stayed sober on until December the 18th, 1938. We'll go into that in just a minute. But here's what the second message was. We admitted that we were licked, that we were powerless over alcohol. We made a moral inventory of our defects or sins. We confessed or shared our shortcomings with another person in confidence. We made restitution to all those we had harmed by our drinking. We tried to help other alcoholics with no thought of reward, money, or prestige. We prayed to whatever God we thought there was for power to practice these precepts. And that was fine. And Bill realized that. Bill W. wasn't much of a... He wasn't very spiritual, but he was beginning to get that way. In 1938, when they decided to write... Bill was a shaker and a mover. He'd been rich twice, and he liked being rich. And he wanted to be rich again, and he wanted AA to make a lot of money. And if Bill had had AA by itself, it never every group would be franchised like Burger King. And if Dr. Bob had had it like by himself, it never would have got out of Akron, Ohio. That's a dichotomy that they were working with. Both of them had two different ends of the pole. And Bill told them they wouldn't let him build a hospital so he could make a lot of money, and they wouldn't do this and do that. But somebody said, we better write a book so we can see what we're doing so it won't get garbled between each other. And we can keep handing it down to people. Bill said, that's wonderful. That's fine. If you'll let me write the book. Now, you got to understand, Bill was an alcoholic and he was a stockbroker. Nowhere in the world had he ever written a book. But alcoholics, we will tell you we can do anything. We have a propensity for that. It's called exaggeration. Some people call it lying. We like to call it exaggeration. But Bill said, I'll write the book. And he did. He started writing the book. He got Dr. Silkworth to write the first chapter there that we read about in the doctor's opinion. And the doctor didn't sign that for 2 years. He wrote it, but he didn't sign it. Bill wrote his story. Then he wrote There Is a Solution. Then he wrote more about alcoholism. Then he wrote We Agnostics. And by that time, he got to a point where he knew the alcoholic needed to see something about how it worked. And he knew how it was working for him, but he knew what I have just read you had a lot of loopholes in it. And he knew that we were loophole experts. And it was December the 18th, 1938, in New York City, and it was in Brooklyn. And it was colder than mother-in-law's love outside, and Lois was working late down at Macy's for the Christmas rush. And Bill was pacing the floor, smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, and said he wasn't in a very spiritual mood at all. But he had to get this chapter wrote because he needed to finish the book as quickly as possible so we could start selling it, because he had done found out he'd write the book and get it published for 50 cents, and he could sell it for $3.50, and he could see a $3 profit there, and that ain't too bad. So he wanted to get it written. He laid down across the bed, and he said a short prayer, put out a cigarette, and picked up a pen and went to writing on this sheet of paper. And he said after the first three or four words, the pen seemed to take legs. And he just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote, ergo this up here. He looked at it had 12 sentences in it that reminded him of the 12 apostles. And he said he liked that. Nobody's ever expounded on that anymore, because he didn't. I never heard him say anything else about it. But this right here, except for the addition to as we understood him in 3 and 11 and and 7, they used to have us down on our knees. And Alcoholics Anonymous took down on our knees out of that. Made it with 200 words. There's 200 words up there, and the first one's we. Together we can, and apart we can't. I can't do it without y'all, and y'all can do it without me. But I got to be around people like you so I can stay sober, because that's the way this thing works. But he wrote that, and the next morning finished the chapter on how it worked. And the book was written in April of 38, and I was there in April of 88 when we sold the 10th millionth copy of that book. And we ate a big cake commemorating that. I've got pictures in a scrapbook at home of that, because it was a glorious day in New York that day. But when he wrote these other steps, he wrote these first three for the HOW. because he knew it was terribly important that the H was the third thing the alcoholic must have after he had that moment of clarity, that little bit of hope. Then he must become honest with himself. Honesty, H-O-W, is the H is for the honesty. The first step says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous in January the 1st, 1971, and I stayed 29 days and didn't treat my disease, and I had to go back out and drink. Because in this fellowship, if you come into this fellowship, it's like going to the doctor and he tells you you've got a disease. Say you've got kidney infection, and he hands you a bottle of medicine and says, here, this, take this. This will get rid of your kidney infection. You don't go home and put it on the refrigerator and leave it sitting there. You start taking it that day because you want to get well. Well, that's what this is up here. This is a medicine for alcoholism. And alcoholism has been described in so many ways, and I like to think that we alcoholics, we take away from our goals to give to our behavior. The non-alcoholic takes away from his behavior and gives to his goals. And to me, that's what I did. I took away from all of my goals that I had such high hope for, because once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. Once I took that first drink, I couldn't guarantee what I would do except get drunk and make a fool out of myself. That was the only guarantee I could give you. And when I left there in 71, I told people I was an alcoholic to get in places. I told them I was an alcoholic to get out of places. I told them I was an alcoholic when they didn't want to hear it, and I told them when they did want to hear it. Just whatever, but I missed one. I didn't tell me. And that's the big thing. That night in Athens, Texas, just a little bit of me knew that that didn't say I was alcoholic. It said I was powerless over alcohol. And that little word, powerless, and powerlessness, is going to be the biggest word that we will find in these 12 steps. I see people that go out and drink. They'll talk about the 8th step or the 7th step or the 4th step or the 3rd step. It's not that. It's the first one. Because the alcoholic thinks he can control, after a while, can come back and be in control. And it's just not likely. Because that's what this whole thing is. I must extend myself. This is the only step that we can work 100% of the time. And I don't like to talk about working the steps. I like to talk about taking them, like the book says, and how it works. If you want what we've got and are willing to go to any length to get it, you're ready to take certain steps. That means to adopt them. Take them down off the wall and put them in your life as a way of life. Because this is about change. Back in early 77, I had been told that I needed to change by a guy that had 8 years in the program. And I told him, he asked me, was I going to drink the next morning because I was getting out of the Terrell State Hospital. And I said, no, I'm not ever going to take a drink as long as I live. He said, yeah, you will. He said, because in order to make the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have to change. You have to change the way you think, the way you act, the way you walk, the way you talk, the way you taste, the way you smell, and you little fast talking so-and-so, you ain't changed nothing. And I made a profit out of him. The next morning I got out. And I got drunk before I had been out 30 minutes till I had my, well, 5 minutes until I had my first drink. And that lasted, as we've already said, to August the 20th. But I wanted to change and I didn't know how. And that's what this whole thing is about. A gradual change into learning how to live without alcohol and how to live with life on life's terms. Finding out. I hear people say, keep coming back, it gets better. I don't believe I've ever seen it get better. We get better. I tried to change it for 41 years, and I never was able to change it. When I started trying to change me, then the good things started happening, because I am powerless. I am powerless over alcohol, and it says that I'm powerless over, that my life had become unmanageable. That means I'm powerless. I'm powerless over people, places, and things. I'm just powerless. I've got a friend in New York City, a black man, and he stands about 6'10", and he weighs about 320, and he walks up to the podium, and he says, hi, my name's Johnny, and I'm powerless. And he is a mountain of a man. And Johnny knows he's powerless because he's an alcoholic, and he's powerless over alcohol, and he's powerless over a way to live. And once I told me and accepted the fact that I was powerless over alcohol, and powerless over a way to live, little things started changing for me. And it happened that first night. It didn't happen all at that first night, but little by little. And the more I said it, the more I knew it was true, that I was powerless over alcohol. And if I am powerless, which I am, then I need to find a power, greater than myself. When I got here, my dad was an elder in the Church of Christ. My mother was a devout Christian. And the only thing I know about drugs is they drugged me to church every Sunday and every Wednesday. And I didn't like church. People say, you know, when do you become an alcoholic? Everybody's got a different stage. I was an alcoholic when I got here, when I was born. I know that because when everybody else said, I stood. When everybody else ran, I walked. When everybody else whispered, I screamed. And I was a problem child all my life. I mean, I didn't have trouble with classes, but I had trouble with direction. I do not like direction. None of you do. None of you like to be told don't. You don't live with the word don't. Alcoholics hate the word don't. I don't like it yet. If you've heard me talk, you know the story I'm going to tell about when I first started speaking in AA. I had 8 months sober. I went to Dallas from up on Cedar Creek Lake to speak at a halfway house. About 35 guys lived in it. And I got up there, and there was two black ladies running it, Mary and Joyce. Mary had 24 years. Joyce had 18. And we sat down and got a cup of coffee. I got there about an hour early. And they were really sober. They really were sober. And they were talking about sobriety, and we got to talking. And I love to talk about, I did then, I still do. I want to talk about the program. And we kept talking. And you know, I know how to act. I know how to act wherever you put me. I was born and raised that way. How to act anywhere. But that day I was very rude. Because Mary and Joyce would be sitting there and I'd get a cup, drink of coffee and I'd listen. And I'd turn my head and I would look over here against the wall. And I'd beg their pardon and we'd go on. And a few minutes later I'm looking at that wall again. And there was a refrigerator, three refrigerators over there. Now I didn't have anything for refrigerators. But I would look over at that, and one of those refrigerators had a sign on it, big sign, said, "Don't squeeze the sausage. Use a knife to cut it into patties." Well, I went upstairs where the hay hall was and talked an hour, and I come back and squeezed that damn sausage. The next year, I went up there, and there was a sign on that refrigerator that said, "Please use a knife to cut the sausage into patties." And Mary said, "We hadn't had a bit of trouble with it since we put that sign on it." So nobody's messed with the sausage. Because alcoholics just don't do don't. But we just don't do don't. That's it. We don't understand that kind of language. It was just this matter of fact that if I firmly believe that I needed a drink to go to school when I was 6 years old. I graduated when I was 16. I got double promoted twice. I don't think it was because I was so smart. I think it was I was so incorrigible. They just wanted to move me on up the ladder and get him out, you know. But if they had had happy hour instead of recess, I'd have been in AA time. I was 8 years old. I mean, because if they'd let us drink then. But that didn't happen because I was irritable and restless and discontent all my life until I got to you people. And when I got that first step and started looking at it, and it is a daily thing, then I could read that second step, and the second step was hinging on things I didn't like. And that's the problem with alcoholics. We don't want to touch things we don't like. And I needed to try this because this may be the last house on the block. I knew that then. I know it now. I would come to this group. Not to this group, but to another group in Tyler, and I would up then. We didn't have, you know, the older a man gets, the further he walked to school when he was a kid. But we didn't have AA like we've got it now. We had to drive all over everywhere, and we would come to Tyler on the nights we didn't have it in Athens on Thursday night, and in Malakoff on Tuesday night, and then we started the Kemp group. But anyhow, I was listening to what everybody said everywhere I went. I listened, and I would hear things like this one over here say. Well, I asked God with his help that I wouldn't take a drink this morning when I got up, first thing I'd done. And then he'd get to somebody else, and they'd say that they got up and asked God with his help. And one night we was in Wills Point, and this was way up in October. And I'd done been around since September the 16th, see? And I'm sitting there, they're talking about this asking God, and it come my time, and I just told them, I said, look, I don't do ye God business, I'm sorry. They said, that's okay, don't worry about it, just keep on coming back. I said, okay, I'm going to. And so, you know, it said, we came to believe. Didn't say we come to believe, it said we came to believe. That a power, not in a power, but that a power could, greater than ourselves, could restore us to sanity. Well, I looked at that, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I just told them, I can't say that. I can't do that. They said, that's okay. Well, the next night, we had our first meeting in camp on Saturday night, and I went up and got up and went to the bathroom. And there's an old man from Athens followed me and stood out in the kitchen, and he just waited for me to come out of the bathroom. His name was Mac. I did his funeral, the first funeral I ever done in my life. When I had 12 years sober and Mac had 5 days having 31 years. But Mac walked up to me that night and he said, I heard you say last night, Wells Point, you didn't believe in God. And I said, yeah, that's right, I don't. He said, well, that's okay. That's all right. But let me let you consider something. I said, okay, what is it? He said, how would you like to believe that there was a God and live the rest of a long life and die and find out there wasn't one? Or how would you like to believe there wasn't a God and take a drink and die and find out there was one? I said, that's an awful lot for me to comprehend. Could you write that down? And he did. Because I never will be as well as I was sick. But that night, I looked at that all weekend. I looked at that all weekend and studied that up. And on the 28th day of October, 77, I got up. And I thought it was about time I might start being responsible and go to work and try to do something. And I went and got the place that I own today by the God's grace and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It ain't much, but it's mine. And I started to work there that day. But before I did that, I got up that morning and I was going somewhere and go to work. I'd already made one change. You see, when I drink alcohol, I'm a men's hairstylist. And when I'm sober, I'm a barber. So I went back to barber. That was the first change I made. It cost me $6, $7 a head, but oh well, whatever. I pulled up, headed out of camp, got up to the Dairy Queen, where the Dairy Queen's sitting right now. In fact, I was by it right yesterday. And I reached over to get a package of cigarettes. And somewhere or another, out of the clear blue sky, I said, Lord, with your help today, I won't take a drink of anything containing alcohol. And I will tell you something. I had a feeling I've never had before. But the real feeling I had was that I'd never have to take another drink if I would do what my God said to do. And my God was my G-O-D, my group of drunks. Because they were the people that were sober, and I was the one that was hinging on anything. And they were telling me to do that, and they had more power than I did. And that was okay. I could come to believe because once I did it, and I haven't missed a day doing it since, and won't if I keep the same sanity I got now, and then I tell him thank you tonight. I'll tell him thank you tonight for a good day. Because any day that I've had that I didn't drink alcohol was a good day. The day my mother-in-law passed away, and I was speaking at a convention last weekend, where she's buried in Arkansas, and I got them to carry me out by her grave, and I visited her grave. And the night she died, I got down on my knees and thanked God for a good day that day. Not because my mother-in-law had passed away, but because me and her daughter, that is a member of this fellowship, was sober enough, and we went up there and took a hold, and we were there for the whole family. When my mother passed away on the same Wednesday of the same month, 8 years later, I got on my knees that night and said, thank you, Lord, for a good day. Because you see, my mother had seen, I'd seen my mother's eyes flash when I came in the room for 17 years because she had seen me sober for 17 years, where her eyes were dead when I saw them previously. And I said, thank you, because I hadn't had a drink. I didn't thank him because my mom had passed away. I thanked him. That was his deal. My deal was I was glad that Mother had seen me sober, and I was there to help my dad. The next year, on the same Wednesday of the same month, which is the second Wednesday in June, I was doing these 12 steps in Rockwall, and I got home that night, and the police knocked on my front door and handed me a note, said, call this number, and I called that number in Dallas. And my son had died from an overdose of heroin that day. And I got down on my knees again that night and thanked him for a good day, because I knew who was going to have to take care of the funeral, and it was fine. Me and my wife could do it with the help of the boy's mother. And because it tore her up so bad, I knew she wouldn't. She didn't have to be, and I told her, I said, you pick out everything, and we'll do it. What I'm saying is, repetition strengthens and confirms habit, and faith becomes natural. The more I said it, the more I knew it was true. And today I stand by it 1,000%. Because today it's not my group of trunks. It's my G-O-D, my God, that Mother and Daddy probably tried to give me when I was a kid and just wouldn't take it. But the 12 and 12, and a lot of people, we have a lot of people that's hollering about the 12 and 12, and I'd like to talk about that just a minute. There's a reason we've got the 12 and 12, and it wasn't to replace the big book. The big book will never be replaced. Bill, I just told you, when he wrote these steps, there was 43 people sober. When he wrote that book, it says there was 100 sober. There was 78, but alcoholics are subject to judge it up a little. We'll exaggerate it up a little bit. There was 100 got sober in a few days, for God's sakes, time they sold a few of them. But it doesn't matter. But anyhow, Bill addressed this on page 121. Of the language of the heart. And he said he wrote this because, you see, in the big book, in step 6, 7, and 8, there's only a paragraph on step 6, a paragraph on step 7, and 3 sentences on step 8. Because he didn't have anybody that had any experience with those steps because they were brand new. So he wrote the 12 and 12 to broaden and deepen the 12 steps for all of us. Sober living does not bring instant immunity from rejection, guilt, grief, rage, or jealousy. This was the steps in the 12 and 12. That's why he wrote so many pages on step 6 and so many pages on step 7, because there was 42,000 people sober by 1952 when he put that book out. And it was just a backup to say, here's some experience if you would like it. But the 12 and 12 says in step 2 that quit being so defiant and start being reliant on whatever power it is you can find. And if it can be your group, it can be whatever power you know that's bigger than you. And that's what I used. Was a lot of people use good orderly direction. And I used my group because that was who I, that's, I listened to them. That's where I found the, that's where I heard the message. But it says could restore us to sanity. That don't mean we're going to be perfect, y'all. There's a lot of people, and I was one of them. I come in here and I thought, boy, if I get to doing all this, I won't even have to pay Sears Roebuck, you know, my taxes or nothing else. But, you know, it's what we're talking about here is not the insanity of driving 85 when you ought to be driving 55. That's just crazy. This is talking about the insanity of that first drink. If sometime tomorrow I think I can take a drink of 1 ounce of alcohol with impunity, I have not been restored to sanity, because that is the most insane thought I can have. It couples up with me killing myself, committing suicide as two of the big, because it won't be instantaneous probably, but it will be quick. Because the alcoholic, just because I have been sober 25 years and nearly 26, that means I'd be 25 years and nearly 26 that further along with the disease, because it never stops inside of you. You still carry this. I mean, it would be 25 years worse if I drank today than it was the last time. And so the fact remains is the first drink is what we avoid. That is what, and I thought that was the craziest thing I'd ever heard. You said, don't take the first drink. And I thought, my God, I can drink 6 before I even feel it. What are you talking about? 4 doubles anyhow, you know, for sure. Well, here we are. 25 years, 10 months and 17 days later, I haven't had that first one. Huh. Could be maybe it's something to that first one, huh? If I don't take that first one, I don't have to worry about that 10th one. Took me along. Like I say, I never will be as well as I was sick. But it says to quit being so, just start being, putting the rest of the 12 steps in your life. And it will happen. Because it said we came to believe. I came to believe well down here. I didn't come to believe right there. That's why he said, and we prefaces every one of this is what we have done to stay sober and get sober and live a sober life. And living a sober life is different from just not drinking. Not drinking is one of the hardest things in the world I could ever do. The hardest things that I have ever done in my lifetime. And there's 60 days of that. 29 I spent with y'all in 71 was the worst 29 days of my life. Because I did not treat my disease and y'all were laughing and I was wanting to kill somebody. 4 more days in that it's too long a story to go into, but I went to a Cowboy football game with another wife, or another woman that wasn't my wife, and I was so drunk she had to carry me home, and I fell over into the yard, and my wife and 2 kids are standing up in the upstairs looking, and they let me in the house, and the next morning we decided I'd quit drinking, and I just quit. We poured it all out of the bar and everything. Early Sunday morning, I'm still pretty drunk, and I made a big mistake, because by 3 o'clock that afternoon, I knew I'd made a horrible mistake. But I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink till Wednesday. And when I got home Wednesday night, my wife handed me her credit card and said, here, go get all the whiskey and anything you want to buy and bring it home and drink every bit of it tonight if you want to. I said, I thought we'd quit. She said, we have. You hadn't. She said, there's nobody can live with you when you're not drinking, but nobody can stand you in within 50 yards of them when you're not drinking. And that was a kickoff to me, because then the 27 days with my, when I sobered up at my mother and daddy's house. But because that 60 days, I was restless, irritable, discontent. I was uneasy. And when they took me to that first meeting, I thought that I would die. It says in the big book in the last chapter there, A Vision for You, the second page, it says, I was worried about would I be. That glum and boring and just all the stuff that I went through those 60 days. And then right on down later it says, yes, there is a substitute and it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it tells us something. The best years of your existence will lie ahead. And I can truthfully say that that's true. The best years of my existence started the day I started with y'all. Because I started to trying to change and be the things I wanted to be anyhow. And with doing that, with just quit being so defiant and start being reliant on whatever it was that the power was, we developed on into step 3. And the second step was the O of the H-O-W, and that was open-minded. I need to today remember that you may be right and I may be wrong. I had to become open-minded, and that's one of the biggest words I ever knew about, because I had to finally believe that Mother and Daddy had been right all along, and everybody else had too, that had any semblance of what life was all about. Because I didn't know what life, I knew what existence was. I had come to the bottom of the very pit from a very good life, supposedly, on down to where I'd become. But I couldn't have. My next stop had to be the graveyard, no joke. And so, pardon me, the third step is the W. And the W is the willingness, being willing. I bet you if I've been asked 100 times, what are you willing to do to stay sober? And this is a good time to talk about the biggest word that isn't in the big book. The biggest word that we've got is called sponsorship. Sponsorship is the best thing that ever happened to us. And it's never mentioned in the big book in the first 164 pages because they didn't have them then. Started in Cleveland. And sponsorship today is the biggest thing in the world. There's 200 words in the first in these 12 steps. The first one's we. There's 237 words in the 12 traditions. The first one's our. I can't do it without some of y'all's help. And I had a sponsor. I called a man, and asked him, would he be my sponsor? He was a banker in Fort Worth. And I said, Jack, would you be my sponsor? And he said, no, I don't sponsor people that drink alcohol. Jack had 7 years, and I had watched Jack sober up, see, and he was my banker. I'd been doing business for him for a long time. And he said, no, I won't fool you because you drink alcohol. I said, Jack, I hadn't had a drink in 27 days, and I went to my first meeting tonight. And Jack knew how I was. He knew me. He knew my family. He knew I didn't like don't. He knew I didn't do rules. And he said, okay, I'll be your sponsor, but I got some rules for you. And I thought, is it ever going to stop? I said, okay. And I got smart with him. I said, Jack, what are your rules? He said, give up, grow up, show up, and shut up. And I thought, what an order. I can't go through with it. He said, give up. That's what I did this morning when I got up. I never have been to the seventh day of June 2003 before in my life until this morning. And I needed some help to get through today. I might run into something I couldn't handle. So I got up this morning and I gave up. I surrendered so I could win. I asked God with his help that I wouldn't take a drink. And I went on and talked about a bunch of other stuff too. And tonight when I go home and when I get in bed, I'll thank him again for a good day because I hadn't had a drink today and not going to have one. When I ask God with his help, that means I got to be part of it. That means that I can't stop on the way from here to Kaufman and get a beer and drink it. I can go in a beer joint and get a beer. That's no problem. God ain't going to knock it out of my hand. My job is not to go in the beer joint. You know, you can't make a pet out of a rattlesnake. And that's what you're doing when you're tempting it. When you're hanging around it or smoking a little marijuana maintenance and stuff like that. You're just looking for a way to get right back to drinking. Third step says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. We made a decision. You know, this is where we start becoming willing to do whatever's asked of us. Because willingness is indispensable. It says we made a decision. It didn't say we was going to do anything else. I made a decision to come from Kaufman down here tonight to talk about these 12 steps. If all I'd have done is make a decision, I'd still be sitting in my den in Kaufman. I had to make the decision and make preparations and come down here. Well, that's what this is all about. This is the third step. And we make that decision because who knows what their will and their life's all about when they first get in here. I wanted to quit drinking. I knew that much. So that much I could turn over, but I didn't know how to turn it over. Wasn't going to know till I got on down the road. But we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Now, this is a monumental place in the alcoholic's life. Because once we make that decision, we start taking responsibility for our own actions. We start taking ownerships of everything we do. We can't blame it off on them and her and him and them. It's us. If I point my finger at you, I got three pointing back at me. And I had to learn that because there's always somebody else's fault. And I watch alcoholics. I study us and I watch you. And I see you doing stuff. And all of a sudden I see you make a mistake and you get a frown on your face and I see you smile and I know you found somebody to blame it off on right then. Because that's just the way we are. It's old habits die hard. But once we start doing this, and that third step is a long, long step, and it's a good step, and it needs to be, you need to concentrate and be sure, because do you want it to be better than what you've got it? Do you want to change? Do you desperately want to stay sober? And if you do, your answer is yes, then you will proceed on. But this is what I found out about step three, and I tell this story because it actually happened to me that same morning that I asked God with his help. You know, alcoholics, there's two or three things you don't do. One of them is you don't read directions. Because who knows more than we do, you know? I don't read directions. They gave me a camera up yonder the other day, one of these little throwaway deals. I tore the damn paper off of it, you know, because I thought you were supposed to. It didn't say that in the directions. I threw the directions away. Then the camera was no good, you know? But, you know, that's the way we do. My wife is 16 years younger than I am. My wife's got a year longer in the program than I got. And they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. But she don't read directions about nothing. And I don't either. And y'all don't either. Walmart ought to have a section for alcoholics only, no directions, dollar off on everything. Because that's the way we handle it. We just don't do directions. Well, you see, that morning I went to a restaurant to eat breakfast, where I go every morning. And by that time, I had tried to prove to myself I wasn't crazy. I haven't finished that yet because I'm still working. I started working crossword puzzles. I thought that would do it. And I've become totally addicted to crossword puzzles. I just work every one of them I can find. That's I got a pencil in hand every morning. I went, and down at the bottom of the page, it'll tell you where that crossword puzzle's at. But you think I read down there? Nope. I got the Dallas Morning News, and I'm flipping through it. I'll find it. And all of a sudden, in the middle of that first section, and you know this is the truth, because the rest of it's not my story. This actually happened in the Dallas Morning News that day of the 28th day of October of 77. And it was talking about something that happened in May back up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I saw that, and it just kind of glared out at me, and I was supposed to read that morning. And I read that article, and here's the gist of the article. There's a minister up there. His name is Oral Roberts. Oral Roberts University. He has a university up there, and he's on TV some. And Brother Roberts has been known for a good. He could get a lot of money together. And I don't know anything about him. I'm just telling you what the paper said. But the paper said that back in May, Brother Roberts was asleep one morning. And all of a sudden, he had somebody shaking on his shoulder, and he woke up, and he looked, and he said, "Is that you, God?" And God said, "Yeah, I got a job for you." And he said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "I want you to build a statue of Jesus out on your campus." He said, "Well, where am I going to get the money?" He said, "You can do it. You can collect the money." "Well, how big is it going to be?" He said, "I got it wrote down right here for you." And so Oral went out, and he's got the statue. Every time, everybody in Tulsa knows that when I come up there, they're going to drive me by that damn statue, because I've got to see it, because I talk about it all the time. And it's still up there a year and a half ago when I was up there. And so he wrote it, he built it, got it built. And on the day he was having the big unveiling, it was raining, just coming in torrents, flashing. And all them guys that give all that money to get that statue of Jesus built was walking around there, walking around. And one of them walked up to him about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and said, "Brother Roberts, if you and God are so close, why don't you tell him to make it quit raining?" He said, "Brother, he's management, I'm labor." That became my third step that day. And it still is today. He's management, I'm labor. I'll do the work if you'll just let me have indication of what to do. And that's what my third step is for me today. Because the third step, you cannot plan your future if you don't clear away the wreckage of your past. There's just not no way of doing it. You cannot live with a past that we've got. You've got to bring it up to date. Because by the time you've been in here and you and a sponsor are putting some steps in on this third step, you're starting to see that alcohol wasn't your problem. That living was your problem, and it was the cause of your drinking. So you got to do something about your living problem. You got to find out how to live life on life's terms. And the only way you can do that is by practicing the third step on a day-to-day basis and the rest of the 12 steps as best you can on a day-to-day basis. Like I said, this is not a dress rehearsal. This is life happening. And my life is involved, and so is yours. But that third step is the rest of the steps. Putting the rest of the steps in your life can be very helpful in seeing in the full meaning of the third step, because the rest of the program depends entirely upon how much you put involved in the 12 steps, how much you really want, how much the decision you make, because we're good at making decisions. We're not good with putting that willingness before. But every time I saw Jack Henning, and every time I saw him then, he would ask me, "What are you willing to do to stay sober? What are you willing? What lengths are you willing to go to?" And I would say anything. He'd say, "Okay, do it." And I never had followed anybody's advice before. I never had, had done the things that you've got to do to stay sober. But, this is just going to meetings and admitting that we're powerless is a far cry from a serenity and peace of mind. And you know, what we've got here, what we're dealing with here, is a disease of the emotions. And we're very emotional people. We love a lot of happening things around us. And before we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, or at least I did, and everybody that I sponsored did, they've got to live a roller coaster life. And every one of you, you can do it in AA too. You can live all of a sudden you'll be euphorically high. And 15 minutes later, you're at the bottom of the ocean, and you're just up and down, up and down, up and down. And that's the way my life was. It was one constant roller coaster. The 12 steps are kind of the Monroe-matics of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't go too high and you don't go too low. You just, you know, just in a little kind of a low. You don't go straight across. Now, that's Valium. We don't do that. We stay inside those 12 steps, and that's what they are. We have, it gives us an emotional thing. Because this this peace of mind and serenity, I had no idea what serenity was when I got to here. And you know, we it takes us a long time to learn to live sober. I didn't have no trouble living drunk. I mean, I had trouble, but I didn't have trouble learning. You screw the top off the bottle, and you got it. That wasn't hard for me. I mean, it was quick done. But living sober is a lifetime job, you know. And serenity, I thought serenity was an old man and old woman sitting out on the front porch, and she was knitting, he was whittling. That's senility. For God's sakes, that is senility. Serenity is the absence of emotional pain, is what it is. And that's what we strive for, the absence of emotional pain. And some days I get through it without any emotional pain at all, and some other days I don't. And you know...
Note to the listener, the original recording was missing the end of Session 1 on Steps 1, 2, and 3. The next session will begin momentarily.